Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Sally Vickers, who's had the excellent good grace to come to my home. So welcome to the official Radio Gorgeous sofa, Sally Vickers.
Very nice to be here, Donna.
We are going to discuss what we think is your eighth novel.
I think it is, yes.
Yes, called Cousins. You are also the author of Miss Garnet's Angel, which was your first, Mr. Golightly's Holiday, and The Cleaner of Chartres, which is your latest, among others.
Well, my latest is Cousins.
Is Cousins, yes, but prior to that, yeah. Thank you. Yes, we're here to discuss Cousins. Could you set up the premise of Cousins and the story, introduce us to the story?
It's about a family. It spans three generations of that family. And in the time scale, it stretches from the First World War to the very end of the 20th century, 1994, except that it's actually being written in the 21st century by one of the characters. It's told in the voice of three women who belong to that family, the Thai family. One voice is the sister of the main male protagonist, and her name is Hetta. One is the grandmother of the two protagonists, and her name is Betsy, and one is the aunt of one of the protagonists and the mother of the second. And the two main characters are Will and Cecilia, and they are the most important pair of cousins in the title. There are two sets of cousins. The grandparents are first cousins and have married. Will and Cecilia are first cousins and never marry. And the story starts when Will falls from the roof of Cambridge College Chapel and suffers a grievous injury which leads to his paralysis. And the three narrators tell both his story and their own part in how he comes to suffer this terrible accident, and what happens as a result of it, and also what it reveals about their past and the secrets in the family.
Yes, and those, it put me in mind of two books and authors that I've been reading recently. One, Jane Gardner's Old Filth.
Mm-hmm.
It had a similar feel, and going back and forth in time, and as well as the pace of Helen Dunmore's books, and the quality of both of those that I really enjoyed about your book is that I thought I knew what was going to happen.
Mm.
I thought, and at each point something was further revealed to me, and it has the pace, I likened it to myself as when I'm riding my bike and I'm going around a curve, and I can only see what's just in front of me, and I have to keep going, and for the, and that really lovely pace of being able to, you know, when you're driving, it's too fast. When you're on a train, it's too fast. When you're walking, it's too slow. When you're biking, for me, it's just right. I get to look around, mm-hmm. and yet I'm moving. I am moving forward. I hope that is a good comparison for you.
Well, I'm very fond of both Helen Dunmore, who sadly just died, and also yes. Jane Gardam, who luckily has not. But all my novels actually go back and forth in time. It's mm-hmm. one of the things I've always done. I've always had at least two perspectives in time, starting with Miss Garnet's Angel, which has the 20th century, and the 8th century BC as its two time.
And why factors. Do you, why is that so compelling to you?
Hard to say, but I mean, I was a psychoanalyst, and psychoanalysis, as everybody knows, deals with the past that is retold in the present. When people come to analysis, they have a story to tell, and the story will go back and forth between the past and the present. And connections are made either by the teller or by the listener, the analyst, between the past and the present. So I think it's sort of second nature for me to move between the past and the present, and to look at the parallels and the reflections and the recurring themes, I think, of the past and the present. And one of the features of this particular novel is the way in which events in the past in a family, even if not known to later generations, get reflected and repeated. It's what I used to call a haunting when I was working as an analyst. There's a haunting of previous histories within the contemporary consciousness of the characters.
Yes, there is definitely a sense of the generations consciously or unconsciously repeating the same patterns of the past.
I think you can't help it. And I did work a lot with families. I worked a lot with families, the children of Holocaust survivors in particular, and with various other groups that whose families had suffered traumas in the past. And one of the interesting things is that it looks as though even if people are really unfamiliar with those past traumas, they will manifest certain symptoms that indicate it is known somewhere in the body, in the unconscious. It's a bit hard to say where. And that is really very interesting to me.
Yes, as it does seem as though we're seeing that so many personality and physical attributes, illnesses, are not the only things that are hereditary. They're not the only traits. Mm. And it seems to me that trauma is also an inherited, sort of somehow inherited in families.
Yes, we don't know how it happens exactly. But there's, you know, I'm a great believer in unconscious communications of all kinds. And this is a very interesting one. And, you know, one I've been able to chart in my previous work as a psychoanalyst, working in many different areas, particularly, I think, with war trauma. So I think that was one of the things I wanted to bring to bear in this particular book about the past. As I say, all my books have something to do with the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how does the... Because there's also an element of spirituality, maybe, I don't know if mysticism is the right word, also in your books, recurring.
Yes. I think they all have... I never quite know what to call it, because if you call it religious, that's going to restrict, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be thought of as a religious writer. But I do believe there are dimensions of human experience that are not explicable entirely in everyday or rational terms, or necessarily scientific terms we are yet familiar with, although we may one day come to be so. I like to call them metaphysical, meta being above the physical, because I think that gives a sense of a more objective sense of what I'm trying to write about. And in this particular book, I suppose the mystical strain, if you want to call it that, is the character of St. Cuthbert. The book is principally set in Northumberland. It has a number of locations. Cambridge is one, dominant one, but the root environment is Northumberland, where actually my father's family, it turned out, came from as well. So I have a special interest in Northumberland. And I became very interested in Holy Island, which was the home of St. Cuthbert and a number of the Celtic 7th and 8th century saints. And that particular brand of Christianity, which was superseded by the Roman brand of Christianity and really died out, which was very interested in the environment and particularly birds and wildlife around the those Celtic shores. And it sort of blent itself very naturally in with the Northumberland environment, that there should be this theme of St. Cuthbert that two of the narrators have quite a close association with, and Cecilia, the young woman with whom Will, her cousin, is in love in a complicated way, also has to do with St. Cuthbert. So he's a presence. And yes, it's true, I do tend to have that sort of presence in all my books, to a lesser or greater extent.
Is that a presence in your life as well?
Well, I was brought up by... my parents were communists. I was brought up in a strictly atheist household. Mm-hmm. Every book was allowed in the household except the Bible. And I think it gave me an interest in those things. You know, people walked around naked. There was no problem about sex. But certainly there was a problem around religion. Mm-hmm. And so inevitably, as with all children, you know, my form of rebellion was to take an interest in those things, which is quite funny. I mean, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, once said to me, I wish I'd thought of that with my children.
Well, I had a friend who we were planning on, if we hadn't found partners, we were planning on, you know, having children and pretending we were really, really conservative so that they would rebel against us.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, exactly.
I forgot to do that with my child.
Yeah, but
anyway, hopefully it turns out all right. And I assume anything that I'm doing, he will be repeating. So, you know, in time-honored family tradition.
But, I mean, I wouldn't say... I'm not conventionally religious, but I do think there is that element in human consciousness, which expresses itself very differently with different people. I mean, some people, it's an organized religion. Some people, it's a disorganized religion or just a form of spirituality. A lot of people, it takes the form of art, music, those kind of things. I do believe those things are connected to religion. And the form of analysis that I was trained in was that of Jung, who did believe that we had a religious dimension and that sanity was connected with the sense that there were other elements within the human range that were not simply explicable by everyday understanding or scientific fact. Although my own view is that science... is still in its infancy, and a lot of things we regard as mystical will have an explanation. I don't think that makes them any less important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean...
why not? You know?
Yeah, I mean, creation, however we came into being, it's pretty amazing.
It's extraordinary, it's extraordinary, and why should it not have an explanation? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of things that were considered to be the province of religion have become the province of science, and I have no problem with that. But I think it's a mistake to think that we are the masters or mistresses of everything, you know, and that there are other things at work.
Yeah, there's another game afoot here.
Another game afoot there in the animal world as well.
Yes, exactly. Which you can probably hear, we have one here.
Yes.
I did want to talk about... actually the cousins and first cousins marrying, which used to be much more prevalent in European society, especially in sort of upper class society.
Kings and queens regularly married their cousins.
Yeah, yes. Keep it in the family.
Yeah,
you
keep
know. But in America, I mean, first cousins, that is, it's illegal. It's incest. And one thing about the book is that you don't... there's not a value judgment placed on it.
Well, there's a very slight one, actually.
Yeah. In the first instance, it would appear, with the first cousins.
In the first cousins, it's not. You see, what's happened, actually, is that in the there are two sets of cousins. One's the grandparents, as I've explained, and one is the grandchildren. In the case of the grandparents, actually, when they marry, it was not such an issue. I mean, Harold Macmillan, famous conservative prime minister in the 50s, famously married his cousin, and there were a lot of inter-cousin marriages about that time. Maybe that was the result of the First World War. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It could be. You know, there was a shortage of young men. Mm-hmm. But it does look as though the position of cousins as incest, as a matter of incest, fluctuates quite a bit.
Yes.
In different historical periods and with different societies. And as you rightly say, if you go back in the history of all the kings and queens of Europe, and probably elsewhere, except I'm not able to judge that, they were all busy marrying cousins, which is probably why some of the dynasties died out.
Yes, they've run out of cousins.
run out of fertility. It is supposed to affect fertility. It is what the real problem is. It's supposed to emphasise any genetic malfunctioning within the the blood, the genes. But it's become less. It's not illegal in England, as you know, in the UK, as you know. It's a little bit frowned upon, but it still goes on. And I did want actually there to be an element of something like incest. I mean, it is suggested that they're really brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that brother-sister love is an interesting one. I mean, I didn't make them brother and sister deliberately because I wanted there to be a potentially romantic attachment between them, but I also wanted it to be threatened, partly for their own psychological reasons, but also partly for this reason of the slight shadow that hangs over it. And it is discussed. There is a sense that both sets of parents, well, one of the parents is a single mother, were uneasy about it, particularly in view of the fact that the grandparents had also been cousins.
Yes.
So,
and they had been thrown together so much as children that they were as if siblings.
They are as if siblings. Now, I think that in itself can create quite an interesting room. I mean, I've written a lot about different kinds of romantic attachments, and I mean, I haven't yet written about an actual incest one, but I might easily. And I think it is, I think one of the cousins, Will, was a twin. His twin sister dies when they're both born. And one of the suggestions is that this boy, who's very brilliant but very disturbed, is looking for a kindred spirit. And he's really, the grandmother says, I think he's looking for his lost twin at one point. And I think what I was trying to suggest is that in the cousin, he's finding the twin he's lost. And I think we all of us at some time, or many of us, I certainly did, have a fantasy of finding our twin soul. We talk about the twin soul. And so in a sense, what they are is twin souls. And a part of me was wanting to explore, I suppose, the pros and cons of that kind of interaction, where it's not the attraction of opposites, but the opposite, the attraction of what's similar.
Yes.
And shared.
And that, you know, the good news is you found your twin soul. The bad news is, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And what does it mean to have a twin soul?
Yeah.
Because if it is somebody you feel is a twin soul, then every little deviation, of course, matters far more. Yeah. Whereas if it's the opposite, you expect the opposite. That's the point of the attraction. If you're looking for a match, then the tiny fluctuations are going to be an immense source of pain and difficulty. And so that proves for Will particularly.
Mm-hmm. Painful, yes. Yeah, it's funny because I'm adopted, so I'm interested in adoption stories. And something they say that when...
I'm interested in those too, yes.
People who are reunited, you know, with lost family, there's very frequently a sexual attraction.
Yes.
And I wonder if it is that familiarity, that unfamiliar familiarity.
I think that's true, and I think it's why incest is a taboo, because, now I forget who said this, it's gone out of my mind for a second, but one psychologist, I won't stop and try and bring it back, but someone of note says, you don't have taboos for things that people don't want.
that's yeah, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense.
of course to be separated from your family as you grow up and then find them would be a terrific erotic surge, whatever form it takes down to. So yes, I was trying to sort of play with all of those ideas that are, you know, a bit forbidden, a bit taboo, but crackle around us in an interesting way.
Is it safer, more fun, less burnout involved to explore these things on the page than in the consulting room? So why did you, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, your evolution from psychoanalyst to writer.
It's very similar. I mean, the big difference is you can't do harm.
Mm-hmm.
You can't harm your characters. You might betray them, you might let them down, you might not do well by them, but you can't actually hurt them. You can do that in the consulting room. Mm. And I think that's something which after a while becomes difficult to go on bearing.
Mm.
I think being the recipient of a lot of intense grief, unhappiness, quite a bit of abuse, trauma, is bound to take some kind of toll. I do miss the peculiar intimacy of that relationship, which is very privileged. I think at its best, it's probably one of the deepest forms of relationship you can find, where people are very, well, should be very open, I mean, with luck, open to each other, and an attentive analyst is also contributing.
Mm-hmm. And it's deeply, I mean, the whole idea of this is to make oneself vulnerable.
Yes.
And that's a huge responsibility.
Yes.
But incredible if you do have that trust.
Yeah, and I think the analyst has to be vulnerable as well. Mm. And it's a very creative exchange. Now, I get something like that with the characters, and it's in fact quite similar, because a character arrives in a way someone I would be seeing in the consulting room would arrive, and all I would know is the name.
Mm.
And, you know, in the past I would know the gender, but nowadays, I mean, that's not so clear either.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually know very little, and the process is one of increasing revelation, which involves work on both sides. It's not just the person who comes to see you revealing things. For them to do so, there has to be...
You have to meet them.
You have to meet them.
Mm.
And I think one of the things you also have to do, at least in the way I was brought up and trained, brought up in a professional sense, you have to find the language to communicate with them. And that was extremely helpful to me in my work as a novelist, because I've had to find within myself the language of my characters and the personality of my characters to meet the characters and for allow the characters to grow out of me and be other than me.
Mm.
So I think there's an awful lot of parallels, actually, between the two things. But as I say, I think the real difference is you can't really do harm.
Yes.
You can write a bad book, but you're not going to be responsible for somebody taking their life or failing to stop them taking their life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a big difference. Mm. There's no question it's helped me. Not that I have ever used anything I was told in the consulting room, but as I said, this facility, developing facility of finding within myself unknown aspects of my own personality with which to communicate with the other, has been, I think, the most useful thing I've found in writing.
Mm. Is it equally as rewarding?
It's rewarding in a different way. I think I can't really judge how equally they are, because it's, you know, things are different.
Mm.
Both have their own stresses and strains. Mm. I mean, there's days when I would profoundly not prefer not to write. I mean, I suppose the difference is I cannot write if I don't want to write, whereas I can't very well say, you know, go away, you bore me, or go away, I'm tired. To somebody,
tired of your problem.
There's a story about Jung opening the door to one of the people he was seeing and saying, go away, you bore me, and that's sometimes told as rather amusing. I think it's disgraceful,
yeah.
Actually. I dislike that story very much. But you can do that when you're writing, because you're not hurting anybody but yourself.
And speaking of history repeating itself, your son is also an author.
He is, yes.
And how is that how does that feel as a mother to have?
Well, I was delighted. Actually, my other son's a vicar.
Mm-hmm.
So the religious dimension has gone.
Much of his grandparents' horror.
They wouldn't have minded.
No.
They were very tolerant. I was delighted. He's a children's writer, which is different. And I think children's writing is wonderful. In fact, I'm writing, the book I'm just finishing is about a children's librarian. And I wrote it partly because I wanted to write about children's books, which I love, And I read to them a lot when they were children, and they both, I'm happy to say, loved books as children and still do. And so it's marvellous. He's also my very best critic.
Oh, excellent.
He always reads my books. I always ask him to.
Mm.
I don't make him, but I ask him to. And he's very good at seeing where I'm showing off.
Ah, that's actually, really required.
And that's very helpful because he knows me well enough to know when it's I'm mucking about, I'm showing off, usually by being irreverent, preposterous. And he says, you know, you don't really have to do that.
It doesn't serve, it only serves you, it doesn't serve the book or the reader.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're doing that for yourself, so don't. Mm. And that's really good because he can spot that better than anybody else.
Ah, fantastic.
And he can also say, there are a number of things he can see, but he can also see where it's good, and that's another thing that's quite good to have. I mean, he wouldn't say things were good if he didn't think so. I know him well enough for that. He might be polite about and not mention where but he certainly wouldn't. So he can see where things are good, and that often gives me the strength to do more in that, you know, more build on that. Mm-hmm. That's really helpful too.
Mm-hmm. And that you can trust it. It's not just,
I totally trust
you know,
him.
It's not blowing smoke up your...
No, he's not envious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say that, you might say, of course not. But
well,
he easily could.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
I mean,
course.
He easily could be envious, and he could easily be critical because of our relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm very, very lucky with him that he's neither of those things, and I do trust him.
Mm-hmm.
I trust his judgment.
I was wondering why Cousins was written from these three women's points of view. And I sort of got the feeling that it was written from their point of view because they didn't know.
I'm very glad you've answered your own question. Because I think you're right. I mean, I've had to think about that because I don't have a theory when I start a book about, you know, what it's about or why I'm doing it at all. And I don't have any theories about the book until it's finished, and really not until people have read it and start to ask me questions about it.
Mm-hmm.
And only then can I start to look at it in a more objective way and think about it. But I try not to think when I'm writing, because I think thought is an enemy of writing. I think it needs reflection, but thought can be interfering and anti-creative. So I think you're right. I originally wrote the book in Cecilia's point of view only, and I abandoned that because I felt that the central relationship between her and Will, I wanted it to be, as you say, something that is only known through other people, because in a way that is true of everything.
Mm-hmm.
We only know other people through our perspectives and other people's perspectives. We never really know what it's like to be another person. Now, a novelist can portray that, and often very convincingly, but I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to convey this couple with all the mystery around them.
Mm.
And I also wanted to, use the different characters' perspective on this couple and their history as a means of self-revelation and self-discovery. So it is as much, in a way, about how the three narrators discover truths about themselves.
Yes, and they evolve.
And evolve through their consideration of other people. Because I think, and I suppose again this is the analyst speaking, the great child analyst Donald Winnicott said that the really difficult patients had been his real education in understanding himself. And I think that is very true.
Mm.
That in thinking deeply about another person and seriously about another person is the most accurate and informative way of finding out about yourself.
Mm.
So it was also an exercise in self-discovery of sometimes very unpalatable truths about themselves that these three women have. But somebody wrote to me and said they're rather like the three fates. And I thought, actually, that is true as well. Yeah. You know, yeah. They are, in a sense, knitting mm-hmm. the fate. Of mm-hmm. There is something about
yes. fate. Or unravelling.
Unravelling and unravelling. Yeah, but there is something about, quite a lot about fate in the book, and how much fate depends on family and genetic inheritance. And I hadn't thought about that, but when he said it, the person who wrote to me, I thought, actually, I think that's true as well.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about learning about yourself through deeply thinking about someone else. And I just got an image of sort of how X-ray works.
Yeah.
So yes, it's sending back a message to yourself, but you're sending something out and it's coming back. Yeah, and you're sort of creating a picture, but it's how it's coming back to you, that it's also, the rays are also coming back to you.
Yeah, and I think that's how relationship works and how deep relationship works. That there's this, as you say, there's the going out, but there's the rebounding back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those sort of, the strength of that in terms of human society and human and psychological relationship is, I think, not adequately understood.
Because we are not what we project.
We're not what we project.
No. No. Which is, I think, getting harder for people to really deeply know with social media. Because, you know, you can fool yourself and other people into thinking they are what they project. Or I am what I project.
Yeah, but exactly.
Not true.
And also we project onto other people all kinds of things that we want them to be or don't want them to be or fear them to be. And we're doing it really all the time. And it's only when you sort of step back a bit and allow yourself to really feel what they're like and how much what they've seemed to be like is what you have put into them, that you begin to get some understanding of your own self, because, you know, a lot of what we project onto other people is really about us.
What we want to see.
Yes.
I'm interested.
Or don't want to see.
I'm interested in how you work, because it sounds like you work very intently and very diligently, and a lot of work goes into, I mean, it's written the book, scrapped the book, rewritten the book, and yet your books come out at a regular pace. So tell me about what your working life is like.
It's different with different books. I mean, Cousins actually took quite a long time. I started it some time ago, and I've started it several times and altered it several times, because actually it's had three versions. It had the version written by Cecilia, then the second version was just written by Hetta, the young sister of Will, and it's only subsequently did I bring in the other two narrative voices, because I felt there was a history to be told that Hetta couldn't possibly know, and therefore it would be interesting. And that's when I got the sort of triple perspective. What is my working life like? Well, it really does differ from book to book. Mm. So I can't give you any kind of pattern. I mean, generally, I've always got an idea waiting. I may have several ideas waiting, in fact, and it's sometimes quite interesting to see which one gets picked up. And it's not always me that makes the decision, it sort of decides itself. I mean, very often something will happen and that will ignite a dormant idea that's been hanging around for some time. So that's a sort of spark that sets something, a slow fuse burning, I suppose. And the early parts of the book are nearly always a bit of a struggle. So there will be a period when it's hard going, and then I get to a point where it's absolutely all-consuming and it's all I ever want to do. And it's really, I don't want to do anything else, I don't want to talk to anyone else, I don't want to go anywhere, I don't want to, you know, I just want to get on with it. And then that's the most exciting part of the book. So that's the best pattern I can give you. But I don't write every day. There are quite long periods when I do nothing. I like to tell myself I'm...
You're percolating.
Brooding.
Yeah, exactly.
But percolating. But who knows what I'm doing.
To the naked eye, looks a lot like lounging around.
Yeah, or, you know, doing the other things I do. But, I can't give you a very good answer on that.
No, that's quite all right. Uh-huh. Thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Cousins is out now from Penguin Books. You've been listening to Radio Gorgeous.